This week we look at a philosopher and at a novelist, and we find out what the one had to say to the other. Moira Gatins is an Australian professorial fellow in the philosophy department at the University of Sydney, and she's about to take on the very important Spinoza Chair for 2010 at the University of Amsterdam. This means she will be presenting the annual Spinoza Lecture at Spinoza House in Rheinsburg, where the benches on which Spinoza worked in the 17th century at his trade grinding optical lenses are still in place. This week, she talks about Spinoza and his influence on George Eliot, the author of Middlemarch and The Mill on the Floss. Moira, welcome to the show and congratulations on your appointment.
Thank you.
Now, before we turn to Spinoza, let's turn to that novelist I mentioned, George Eliot. We know her as a novelist, author of Middlemarch and of Mill on the Floss, but you would certainly argue that she was more than this or something other than this, wouldn't you?
I certainly would. She was a translator and an editor of the Westminster Review before she became a novelist. That was in 1856 that she started writing novels, already quite old by normal standards. So she took her training, really, in what we would call today probably journalism with the Westminster Review.
And as a translator, what did she translate? Was she a jobbing translator, or are we talking about a project of translation here?
I think she was paid anywhere from £20 to £25 for translating some of the most difficult texts in the mid-19th century. For example, David Strauss's Life of Jesus, very difficult German. Also Ludwig Feuerbach's The Essence of Christianity, and very interesting for our present purposes, from Latin to English, Spinoza's Ethics.
Now, you've said that you would argue that her novels should be understood as attempts to practice philosophy in an alternative key. She's not the only person to work on fiction as well as philosophy. There was Jean-Paul Sartre, of course, and there was Albert Camus. But Iris Murdoch, who also wrote both, was rather insistent that there was no connection between the two. Somewhat unconvincingly, I've always thought. But how did the two of these activities figure in George Eliot's career?
I think the comment about Murdoch is a very interesting one. It seems to me that one could be a philosopher and a novelist, and there may not be very much relation between the two kinds of activities. Like you, I'm a little bit suspicious of Murdoch because I think her novels are deeply philosophical novels. I don't think she's someone who did philosophy on the one hand and wrote literature on the other. Those two activities, it seems to me, were intertwined for her. For George Eliot, here I think the work of Feuerbach was quite influential on her. He argued that philosophy needed to become more empirically based, more sensuous, to acknowledge embodiment, to acknowledge the I-thou relation. And I think her translation of The Essence of Christianity had a very profound effect on her. So part of what I take to be the philosophical component of her novel writing is that, she says in a letter, she's not an ordinary novelist. She's not a standard novelist. She is a realist novelist. I think that she saw her own work as being deeply philosophical.
She was not a standard novelist, but she wasn't a standard philosopher either. Philosophers sometimes use fiction or drama, other people's fiction or drama, as a source of examples of, say, moral dilemmas. I take it you're saying that this wasn't what she was doing. It was nothing as simple and reductive as that.
Quite. My argument is that some of the things she wanted to show philosophically could only be shown in that very rich, textured context of fiction. Keep in mind that any novel of hers you want to mention involved an enormous amount of research. She typically either set her novels 30 to 50 years back in time, so that it's not difficult to research that kind of area, or the novel which most people take to be a failure, that is Romola, is set late 15th century Florence. And she researched the life in late 15th century Florence for almost 2 years.
I presume she was not, this follows on from my previous question, she wasn't just thinking philosophical thoughts and then dressing them up in literary form.
No, I think at the time that she's writing and Feuerbach are writing, the relationship between theology, religion and philosophy was much stronger than it came to be in the 20th century. She is attempting to think about religion philosophically in her novels. What this means is she's thinking about big questions, accountability, responsibility, free will, determinism, how the environment or the social or political or economic context of an individual affects their behaviour, what they're capable of doing or becoming. One thinks here of Dorothea in Middlemarch, a person of enormous talent who achieves what she manages to achieve, very much constrained by the context of a mid-Victorian woman's life.
Well, I certainly want to talk to you a little later about Dorothea and what happened to her, but let's look at how Spinoza figured in what George Eliot was doing. And before we do that, let's talk a little about him. Who was he?
Spinoza was a Jewish philosopher who lived in Amsterdam, mid-17th century. Probably descended from Portuguese or Spanish Jews escaping the Inquisition. He left the Jewish community, not entirely of his own free will, and became, as you mentioned earlier, lens grinder to support himself, but also a philosopher. The only text of his that was published during his lifetime was the Theological Political Treatise, and in that treatise he argues about how religion should figure in political life and the controls that governments should or shouldn't have over the religious beliefs and practices of its citizens.
A little before Spinoza came the figure of the great French philosopher René Descartes. Now, Descartes famously established a dualism between the mind and the body, and essentially privileged the mind. He thought the mind was more important than the body. It was never quite as simple as people make it out to be. But how did Spinoza stand in relation, because I know he certainly read Descartes and wrote about him, how did Spinoza stand in relation to that dualist tradition?
Well, he was very critical of it, and also of the way in which Descartes, in part, was attempting to allow a mechanistic scientific worldview in without disturbing religious theological authorities too much. So, you know, his view is the body is a kind of automaton, and the mind is where will and so on comes in. Of course, as you say, it's not so simple as a dualism, because he says, of course, the mind isn't in the body like a pilot is in the ship or like a sea captain is in his boat. Rather, the mind and body are intermingled. But of course, it's very difficult to explain how they're intermingled. So Spinoza rejects the free will thesis, which, interestingly, perhaps we could talk about this later, does not mean that he rejects the conception of freedom. So, yes, he rejects a certain kind of dualism and argues that the mind is the idea of the body. One of the things that this does also is completely bypass the problem of skepticism, because what we know, at least at a basic level, is the impressions that other bodies leave or make on our body and vice versa.
Yes, I suppose you could say that Descartes was saying that what we know of the body is impressed upon our immaterial minds, but we can't trust this information. I think there's a world outside me. No, I could be mistaken about that. I think I've got an arm. I could be mistaken about the arm. I could be mistaken about just about anything except my own existence, and by my own existence it really means the existence of my mind. So that is an attempt to tackle a very fundamental skeptical question. What do I know? Well, not a lot.
Exactly. You put that extremely well. Spinoza, of course, would think I can be mistaken about the impressions of the external world on my body in terms of what that external object actually is. But what I'm not going to be mistaken about it is that I do experience an impression of some kind. That is, I am in a world in which things affect me and I affect them.
He had, as George Eliot had, a distrust of another kind of dualism, the separation of reason and the imagination.
You'll get argument about that from some people. I'm certainly on the side that argues that he takes the resources of the imaginative life and emotion very seriously, and as having both destructive and constructive possibilities.
What then is the role of the imagination for him?
I think the role of the imagination is where all human life begins, as distinct from organisms. There would be no truly human life without the imagination. The imagination is what binds human beings together. He has, well before Freud, a very interesting view, which we would call today probably something like infantile transitivism, whereby if you're happy, I feel the impulse to laugh. If you're crying, I would have a feeling of sadness, and so on. So this kind of notion of sympathy. Moreover, almost all our social life begins with the imagination, including religion. We are beings who have certain kinds of goals, ends or aims, and we tend to project these imaginatively onto nature. This is one of the ways in which religion gets off the ground.
Descartes, I presume, would have said that what makes us human is not the imagination, but our rationality, and it is in our rationality that we differ, say, from animals, which in fact are essentially automata. There's nothing going on inside an animal. I assume that Spinoza is saying that we are both imaginative and rational.
Spinoza would certainly think that human excellence resides in reason, but the imagination of the human and the imagination of the dog or the cat, for him, are all distinct. So there's a lovely passage in the Ethics where he talks about lust, and he says the lust of horses and insects and human beings are all different, and they're different partly due to the structure of their bodies.
You've talked about his view of religion. Given that he was a Jew who had been expelled in fairly uncompromising terms from the Jewish community of Amsterdam, what in greater detail was his view of religion? He wasn't entirely hostile to it, was he?
That's my view. He was hostile to theologians who didn't keep to their own domain, that is, the domain of belief and faith, but rather wanted to interfere with government, with the state, with legislation concerning what citizens could and couldn't do. But religion, I think, is a different matter. He thought, quite rightly, that most people are not going to have the leisure or the time to be philosophers. Some people don't have the capacity to be philosophers. And for these people, religion provided guidance to life, how to treat others, how to be sociable.
So it's not a set of illusions. It is a form of knowledge.
I think it's a form of knowledge that certainly has some illusory aspects, depending on how you want to think about illusion. But one of the things that I'd be keen to stress is that imaginings that we have might be false in one sense, but in another sense they have true, real effects. So it may be the case that you have a false belief, but if that belief is widely shared and becomes embedded in institutions, legal institutions, say, then these beliefs come to have the force of truth in the sense that they are real and they have real effects.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'm talking to Professor Moira Gatins from the University of Sydney, who's just been appointed to the Spinoza Chair for 2010 at the University of Amsterdam. And we're talking about Spinoza, the great 17th century philosopher, and also a great 19th century novelist, George Eliot. Moira, let's return to George Eliot. She, as you say, translated Spinoza's Ethics, and in her manuscript copy of her translation, one phrase, and according to your account, one phrase only, is underlined, and that phrase is, "The mind does not err from the fact that it imagines." What does that mean, and what do you think it meant to her?
Well, put into a broader context of the ethics, he's actually talking about the sun, that, you know, to a casual observer, the sun might appear to be 500 yards away, you know, whatever. When one knows the true distance of the sun from the earth, that is when we have accurate astronomical knowledge, it doesn't change the way that the casual observer sees the sun. Or, you know, take the Humean example. We still talk about the sun rising and setting, even though we know that, strictly speaking, that's not the case.
This is David Hume, the Scottish philosopher of the 18th century. Yes.
Yes. So one of the things that I take it that he's saying there is that the imagination continues to influence us, continues to dominate the way that we perceive the everyday world. It seems to me the difference between the philosopher and the person on the street is that the philosopher may still have many of these imaginings, but the philosopher has a different attitude towards them.
The attitude being what? To know that they are imaginings?
Well, if you think of the parallel line example where you have the arrowheads facing different directions, everyone looking at those thinks one looks longer than the other. But there's a difference between having that simple perception and understanding how it is that you come to have that perception, perhaps by understanding certain kinds of perceptual illusions. And I think Spinoza is saying something similar, that it may be the case, for example, that religion is largely imaginative. A philosopher may have that view and nevertheless think that religion is a very good thing.
Obviously, Spinoza is not Richard Dawkins, is he?
Spinoza, I think, would be ashamed at the level of reasoning that we find in that particular text of Dawkins, yes.
Let's look at how, for George Eliot, this is played out in fiction, and let's look at Middlemarch. How does it work here?
Well, one of the ways that I'd connect Eliot back to Spinoza is, if you think about Spinoza's philosophy, everything is connected to everything else. And I think Middlemarch is an astonishing work, partly because everyone who writes about it talks about the web. It's an astonishing achievement, partly because everything and every character in that incredibly complex novel connects to everything else. So an action of one person that might appear trivial can end up having extraordinary consequences for one of the other characters. She says in Middlemarch that from this vast web of human life, she will take this one tiny microcosm. But what she says of that microcosm that's Middlemarch is meant to apply more broadly to human life in general. So things that happen in London affect Middlemarch. Things that happen in Paris would affect Middlemarch and vice versa. So I think that's right, but I think that it's important to see that it's not just in a small community that this is the case. For her, I think it is the case that all human life is interconnected.
In the novel, Dorothea, whom you've already mentioned, a woman full of sympathetic imagination, marries the elderly scholar, Mr. Casaubon, in the hope that he will open up to her a new world, the masculine world of knowledge. It is, of course, a disaster, a very sad disaster for both of them, really. But I presume you wouldn't say this is not just a simple dramatisation of a clash of temperaments, is it?
No, I think she's doing very many things with those two. And here, I think, is part of the philosophical complexity. Casaubon is, as you know, trying to work on his magnum opus, The Key to All Mythologies, which is attempting to prove that all religions originally come from the one revealed religion. So she's very much engaging with the crisis of faith that marks Victorian culture. Also, the novel is framed by Saint Teresa, begins and finishes with Saint Teresa. Dorothea is a kind of secular saint, but not the kind of saint whose greatness is transcendent, but whose greatness is through the everyday actions that she engages in that make those around her have a better life. Dorothea is one of these, as she says, who will lie in the unvisited tomb, not the great Saint Teresa. And this, again, I think, is telling us something about the Feuerbachian view of religion, that we've got to come back to the love, forgiveness, redemption that we can give to and find in each other, not fixate on these imaginative transcendent figures.
A couple of things emerge for me here. One is you've returned to the figure of this 19th century German Ludwig Feuerbach, who is often read, I think, through, insofar as he's read at all these days, through the prism provided by Karl Marx, and he's thought of as being simply the man who exposed religion as the sham that it was. But he obviously has a far more subtle view of it than that.
Part of my project is I would really like to bring poor old Ludwig out from the shelf. You know, it seems to me that he's a slim volume being crushed by Hegel on the one side and Marx on the other. And this is what everyone says about Feuerbach. He was just the stepping stone from Hegel to Marx. And I think he has a lot more to offer than that. And one of the reasons why I think Eliot is such an interesting figure is that she brings the Spinozistic view, the Feuerbachian view together. And so, yeah, one of the things I really would like to do is to return to Feuerbach. One of the reasons being that he stresses not the critique of Christianity isn't a critique of religion. And it seems to me that he is somebody who does not want to kill a certain kind of religion or spirituality. And I think Eliot, I would also put her in that camp.
The other thing about Feuerbach is, unfortunately for Mr. Casaubon, he's living some 50 years in the past when George Eliot is setting her book. If he'd lived in George Eliot's own time, he could have read her translation of Feuerbach and her translation of Strauss's Life of Christ. And that probably would have helped him in his work, wouldn't it?
If he is capable of having an open mind, yes. But from what we know, one wonders. He does have critics who suggest he should be reading some of the German material, and he rather stubbornly doesn't.
And she does give, I have to say here, she gives a wonderful picture of him wandering down these murky corridors
labyrinth
of thought,
line,
yes, and not getting anywhere.
Yes.
It's a wonderful picture of the, we've all been there probably, arid scholarly life.
Let me tell you, that I've read Middlemarch many times. When I first read it as a 19-year-old, I thought Dorothea was lovely, and I thought Casaubon was a horrible old man. He's 47 years old. When I read it recently, I thought to myself, this Dorothea, this silly young woman who doesn't know what she wants, has ruined this poor man's life. And I think that is very much to do with having a certain sympathy for the life of the scholar, the lonely, dry life of the scholar. Yep.
And for Eliot, the story of this relationship, and indeed the story of other characters in Middlemarch, like Dr. Lydgate and so on, this is a tragedy, but it's an ordinary tragedy. It's not Hamlet.
Exactly. And she says quite similar things in Adam Bede, in the wonderful digression in Adam Bede in chapter 17, where she talks about realism and many of her novels. What she wants her readers to do is to look at the everyday, to look at the ordinary, to look at ordinary suffering. And she's attempting to incite our sympathy for the ordinariness of suffering. And I think she's someone who didn't have a particularly rosy view of life. She thinks that much of life is a burden and suffering. And the only thing that makes such a life redeemable is the love that we can give to each other and the understanding we can give to each other.
Moira Gatins, who's about to take on the Spinoza Chair for 2010 at the University of Amsterdam. You can add your comment about this program via our website, which is also the place to go for our complete audio archives, stretching back all the way to our very first show, abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone. Studio production this week was by Charlie McCune. I'm Alan Saunders. I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
We trust you've enjoyed this ABC Radio National podcast. Head back to our website to find a range of programs you might also find of interest, including the history program Rear Vision. In today's information age, we know when things happen almost immediately. but often we don't understand why. Rear Vision attempts to change this by presenting contemporary news and current affairs events in their historical context, both informative and engaging. You can find Rear Vision to stream or download at the Radio National website.